All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Our first case this morning is 2021-742, State of Ohio versus Jaquan Jackson and Allegheny Casualty Company and Daniel Sifu. For the appellant, Ms. Kelly.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I think the main issue in this case is, why is this important? And why should this be in front of this court at this time? We have as surety, have a due process right. And we were denied our due process rights. And it was on a twofold issue. The first issue was, under the statute 2937-36, the shall language, which is mandatory, required that we got 15 days notice, followed by show cause, 45 to 60 days to actually produce an escaping defendant to the court. In our instance, this is really an evidence of a ghost docket. There are a number of required entries that are just missing from the docket. And the most important one was the defendant's failure to appear. He did not appear on April 17th. There's no sentencing deadline. There's all of a sudden a bond forfeiture on May 21st. The wrinkle in all of this is our bail bondsman was indicted on federal charges, and he was not protecting the surety's interest. But we did not get notice of this, and it greatly prejudiced us, and the bond was forfeited in the full amount of $50,000. So we've gone through this travail of notices, and is there prejudice or is there not? We maintain that the statute and the legislature revised this statute in 2011 and did not require a finding of prejudice. It's not in the language anywhere, but case law is now, the evolution of case law in the different districts is now injecting this prejudice into this statute that really is not written in there. And we maintain there should not be.
If it were in there, do you think we could find that there was prejudice?
Well, we obviously believe, Justice Stewart, that there was prejudice, that the fact that we were not afforded the necessary 15-day notice is prejudice to us. The problem with this is he went over state lines, 19 miles over state lines from Cincinnati to Kentucky, the very next day after pleading out. He hadn't even been set for sentencing. And goes over to Kentucky and gets jailed the very next day. They refuse to release him, allow him to video conference, nothing. We cannot process.
So had you gotten notice properly as the statute requires,
yeah,
what could you have done?
If we had gotten notice as the statute had required instead of coming after the fact, we could have pushed, it still state action would have been required, but we could have pushed for an extradition order. For the prosecutor to go in, get a hold order, get an extradition order, or at the very least, get some sort of accommodation so we could have continued to process them for those Hamilton County claims. This is not, if you notice the evolution of the cases, they are if, you know, defendants run amok. In the Supreme Court cases, they bonded out again, they've been on a crime spree, or they've been out and missing and escaped for months sometimes. Our guy, very next day, he's incarcerated in a neighboring jurisdiction, never to be laid hands on again. So we were very much prejudiced. We could not force anybody to get an extradition order, nor did we know because the delay was so long.
Did you know that he was liable to be arrested and detained in Kentucky?
No.
So when you draft a bond for someone,
right,
you don't check and see what you know, where the danger spots are in order to assess your risk?
Absolutely. We do assess the danger risk, and we look to see, have they had other criminal charges? He literally pled out, and the very next day he was picked up in Kentucky.
Why was he picked up in Kentucky?
Drug charges, and I think he was driving without a license.
Okay.
And they saw he had these charges in Ohio. They kept him, and he, in fact, was incarcerated in Kentucky and has since been released back to Ohio.
So when the bond was written, he had an open warrant?
He had no open warrants. When the bond was written, he only had this case pending.
And the bond specifically stated, do not leave the state.
As conditions of, yes, under Criminal Rule 46, the general conditions are, do not leave the state, do not have victim contact if it's a victim crime, and, you know, do not use drugs and alcohol, and obviously check in and attend court. But in assessing a bond risk, the fact that the very next day he goes over state lines and commits this crime, and then there's no notice to the surety whatsoever. There's only notice to the bail bondsman, who's obviously not doing his job because he's indicted under federal charges. It denied us our due process.
So if, had you known immediately when he was arrested in Kentucky or when he didn't show up for his hearing,
right,
and you tried to get him extradited and you could not facilitate that, would the bond still been subject to forfeiture?
At that point, the bond still would have been subject to forfeiture, but we would have had an opportunity, which we were denied, of actually getting an extradition order or working to get his charges processed. This was so after that fact, we didn't have that opportunity.
Okay, so for your second proposition, mm-hmm. So assume you did have notice, tried to get him extradited, could not. You argue that his detention in another state is still problematic.
Very problematic. If he had, and the district court cases that have come down, the appellate district court cases are, if you're in Ohio and Ohio is an obligee because the state of Ohio is the charging party, it's an impossibility of performance. So 19 miles separated us, and the first district inferred that if he had in fact been jailed in Ohio, that would have been state action, Ohio, and likely we would have been forgiven under the bond. But the fact that he walks 19 miles over, we're still denied it because we have no power to extradite him. And again, it's so long after the forfeiture that we even find out about it, our hands are tied and we can do nothing.
But why is his violation of the terms of his bond, leaving the state, why should that relieve the state of being able to forfeit, have the bond mount forfeited?
And I totally get that. It's really a difference with the fact, it's a difference without a distinction. If he was jailed in Ohio, there would have been an impossibility of performance. But because he was jailed out of state, that went away, and it becomes, as the first district found, a business risk to the surety. Well, that in bail reform, that would discriminate against sureties in Ohio to continue to write bonds, because literally you're rolling the dice. You're not really assessing the risk of the defendant anymore. You're then rolling the dice that if he gets jailed, we don't have the possibility of picking him up through our investigators and bounty hunters. He's in jail. There's nothing we can do. And then that full penalty is forfeited. That's what's not fair. It's really the impossibility of performance, as 21 other states have trended towards, is the fact that if you're incarcerated somewhere, this guy wasn't running amok and we were not doing our job in apprehending him. He was literally jailed the next day. If if you've got this impossibility of performance here in Ohio, whether it's in Ohio or Kentucky, we obviously have a lot of neighboring states around us, that should excuse the forfeiture, and under Hughes, that should be production of the body or for good cause otherwise shown. And we submit that that was good cause otherwise shown.
Just procedurally, when looking through the record, the entry of the trial court adopting the magistrate's decision, doesn't appear to adopt the correct decision. The number's correct, but the caption is not, and the date of the hearing is not, and the actual judge is not. How do we deal with that?
I wish I could tell you. This is, I call it the ghost docket, because so many odd things happened that had no records of happening. Like that September 4th hearing that Mr. Sifu, as our bail bondsman, did not attend. There is nothing on the docket that ever happened. And then the magistrate Birding's decision comes down September 27th, and for the first time, we get that in the mail, and they hire me to come forward. I wish I could explain. There's also a very curious entry that says the surety is no longer under penalty. And I've never understood that. And I've asked the trial court, I've asked the appellate court. I don't understand this entry. It made it sound like we were out from under the forfeiture in the very last line of that magistrate's opinion. And I briefed that and asked that question, and to this day, nobody has answered it. So it's very curious.
Well, you know, what I'm concerned about is Civil Rule 53D4A states that a magistrate's decision is not effective unless adopted by the court. And we've adopted that in some of our case law. Mm-hmm. So do we even have jurisdiction? Did the appellate court have jurisdiction?
That's a good question. It was found to be a final appealable order by Bernadin, but I absolutely hear what you're saying. There was never, that was the problem with this case. There was never the procedures and the proper types of things on the docket. Under Guzman, you speak through your docket entries. Appellee has told us, you know, you had constructive notice of everything. We did. If you looked at the docket, a number of very important events are missing. And yes, that was not done. There was no adoption of the magistrate's opinion.
So which entry? Is there a separate entry that states it's a final appealable order?
Bernadin, and we did have a hearing in November, and then he denied our motion. I believe it was March 23rd, and that was the final appealable order. So he did, the trial judge did actually hold a hearing based on my really late trying to overturn the opinion of the magistrate on the fact that we had just gotten notice, I appeared, and he said, fine, we'll have a hearing on this, had a hearing in November, and then he denied our motion in March.
So you actually filed objections?
Oh, absolutely.
And that's what he held the hearing on?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I wish it were a neater record. It's a mess. So that's kind of half of why I think we're here.
So, counsel, you filed objections after reviewing the magistrate's decision and this bogus type of acceptance of the affirmance of the magistrate's?
What happened was, yes, we found out the September 27th magistrate's opinion. We came forward and filed our written objections. And then Judge Bernadin, who at that time was the trial court judge, brought us in for a hearing in November.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah. But during the process, you're looking at the documents.
Mm-hmm.
You have the magistrate's opinion. Then you've got this entry adopting the magistrate's opinion, right?
No entry, a hearing by the judge. We oppose.
There's a document in that Justice Bruner just referred to, accepting the magistrate's report.
The March 23rd order that I'm aware of with the court was basically adopting it after we had the hearing, but it was not within the 2 weeks.
I'm looking at a December 31st, 2019 entry.
And I'm sorry, what does it say?
And it's captioned for Judge Kubicki, but it has this case number.
Oh, yeah, that's wrong. No, I've never seen that judge associated with this case.
It's the entry approving and adopting the decision of the magistrate.
No.
So is there an order out there
adopting the report of the magistrate signed by the trial judge, and you just didn't, or it didn't get into the record?
What I believe is it did not follow the typical path. And what I believed happened was, after our hearing in November, his then March denial of my motion, that was basically his adoption of the magistrate's opinion, affirming it, and penalizing us the full amount of the bond. But that other judge never.
Well, then how did it get in the record? I mean, you're the appellant, right? So you were the one that went and identified the things in the record. You had the obligation to go check the record and make sure the documents that you identified were in there, so.
No, you're correct. I can't explain that entry. It's, this docket was handled not in the typical manner.
I understand you're saying that, but what goes in the docket in the Court of Appeals, the way it works is that the appellant would go down, they would go through the docket entries, they would choose which ones were going to go to the Court of Appeals, and then it's your obligation to make sure that those are actually in there. So are you saying that the Court of Appeals put something in the record that wasn't there? They put something that you didn't identify in?
I don't believe that they would have done that purposely.
Well,
but did you
go look at what was in the record?
We've looked at what was in the record.
So if you looked at what's in the record, then you saw that this shouldn't have been in there, according to you. So did you do something about it?
I need to look at the entry before my rebuttal and look to see how it was. But that judge never appeared in this, to my knowledge, after I came into this case. It was always Birding and Judge Burnett.
Right, but I understand, but I'm just, you're the appellant. You're responsible for the record.
I agree,
so.
Yes. Yeah. I will look at it. But in any event, as this case has not gone smoothly, as we can see through this process, we maintain that there is an impossibility of performance, that this court can follow the moving trend of other courts and show that if somebody is incarcerated and not available to be processed, that should excuse under Hughes, as otherwise shown, the production of the body and excuse this forfeiture.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sayre, can you help me? It's over here. This, I'm still just a little baffled by this entry because it bears your signature as assistant prosecuting attorney. It has Judge Kubicki at the top. The parties are not the right parties. It's Lattimore, Lanning, and Allegheny. And then at the bottom, there's a line for Judge Baradon, but it's signed at the top by Judge Kubicki, or initialed, and it says entered December 30th by him, and then apparently entered December 31st, maybe in the file?
I think I could provide an explanation for that, Your Honor. I believe that was an entry on a different bond forfeiture case that was simply docketed in error. Apart from that, I can't think of any reason else why it would be in there.
But it has this. It has the correct case number, and it has Baradon at one point, who obviously didn't touch it. So that would be it probably emanated from some kind of error, and the clerk's office just filed it under the correct file number without looking at the contents?
I believe so.
But you signed it, right?
I did, and I believe it was just a typographical error on my part, and then it was not caught by the Hamilton County Clerk's office before it was filed.
Who creates the entry?
I create the entry.
Okay. Thank you.
Your Honors, I want to, before I go into the appellant's propositions of law. I just want to briefly go over the timeline we have here. Jaquan Jackson, the defendant in this case, was indicted by Hamilton County Grand Jury on November 2nd, 2018. As part of his case, he signed a recognizance for appearance that was also executed by an agent of the appellant. And in that recognizance for appearance, Mr. Jackson promised that he would appear in court and that he would not depart the state of Ohio.
Mr. Sayre, I'm sorry. So was this entry for the Lattimore Lanning case, or was it for this case?
I believe it was for the Lattimore case. Like I said, I think it was a typographical error on my part, and I just didn't catch it before I submitted it to the clerk for filing or the judge for signature.
Well, did anyone sign an entry adopting the magistrate's decision?
So on March 24th, we have an entry overruling the objections of the appellant of Allegheny, and I believe adopting the decision of the magistrate.
You don't know for sure if the entry actually adopts the magistrate's decision?
Ordinarily, I would submit an entry after objections overruling. However, in this case, the appellant filed the notice of appeal before I could formulate an actual entry adopting the magistrate's decision, and the case at that point was stayed, if I'm remembering correctly.
So there was a notice of appeal filed before the magistrate's decision was adopted?
It was filed upon the execution of Judge Baradon's March 24th order overruling the objections of Allegheny.
And did that order overrule and adopt, or just overrule?
I believe it just overruled, but it's possible.
So then is there a final order problem with the...
If the entry did not adopt the magistrate's decision, if it was simply overruling the objections of the magistrate, I believe there would be a final order issue here.
You just told me you thought that it did adopt it.
I believe you just told
Justice DeWine that it didn't.
I believe that it did, but I would need to see that entry again.
But it's not in the file, and it's not in our record.
The March 24th?
Is it?
I believe it is, Your Honor, if I can check real quick. It's... Sup 46 of the trial court's record.
We only have it in hard copy. Do you have a copy here?
I do not. I apologize, Your Honor. But it was an entry docketed on March 24th of 2020.
Thank you.
This recognizance of appearance, the appellant promised to ensure that the defendant would appear in court and would not depart the state of Ohio. As we know, upon pleading guilty, the defendant immediately left the state of Ohio in violations of the terms and conditions of that bond.
I'm sorry, counsel, let me stop you for a minute. Sure. Does the surety guarantee that the defendant won't leave the state?
Yes, sir.
Or just does the defendant have to promise not to leave the state?
My reading of the recognizance form, Your Honor, is that the appellant, that the sureties promise to ensure the appearance of the defendant, that he will not depart the state without leave. That's my personal reading of the bail bond.
Okay.
As we know, he did immediately leave the state, and as a result, Judge Baradon ordered this bond forfeit on May 21st, 2019. And to address appellant's first proposition of law, this 15-day requirement. Although the statute that governs this procedure is Revised Code 2937-36C, and that specifically reads that the magistrate or clerk shall notify the accused and each surety within 15 days of the declaration of the forfeiture by ordinary mail. Now, I understand that the term shall is used here, and that term is ordinarily mandatory, that it is a mandatory provision in the revised code. However, the case City of University Heights v. Allen, the court looked at this, and the court found in that case that there was no evidence that the Ohio General Assembly intended that that strict compliance with this 15-day rule was a statutory prerequisite for proceeding with a forfeiture. In support of that, the statute itself provides no remedy for a failure to issue service within the 15 days. And furthermore, Revised Code Section 2937-40A actually expressly sets forth the different ways that a surety can be relieved of its responsibility under a bail bond. The first is that the surety brings the defendant into open court and surrenders the defendant to the court. The second is that
Well, Counselor, they said, but if there's no notice of that, that he has failed to appear, that, you know, then how do they know
that? There are some cases that address when late notice goes out. And appellant cited a few cases as well, but district court, in this case, it is important to note that notice did go out to the surety of this show cause hearing. It came out late. I believe it was 33 days past the statutory time frame, but service was done upon Allegheny, attempted upon Daniel Sifu, and attempted upon Mr. Jackson.
Should there be a prejudice analysis here?
I believe so, Your Honor, and the cases that I've cited in my brief support the proposition of a prejudice analysis. Appellant has cited some cases that for the proposition that the prejudice analysis should not take place. However, none of those cases expressly deal with this 15-day rule. They cite the case State v. Dye, where that was listed as a proposition of law for the court, but the court's decision in that case did not reach the 15-day requirement. There's State v. Kinsner. But in that case, the trial court set the show cause hearing 20 days after the forfeiture instead of the required 45 to 60, therefore depriving the surety of an opportunity to bring the defendant back as allowed by the statute. And then in State v. CL, the court never issued notice in the first place. It has been almost uniformly adopted by the districts that unless the surety can demonstrate prejudice for late notice, that the forfeiture may move forward. And there's nothing in the statute and there's nothing in the legislative history that indicates that the Ohio General Assembly simply would have intended that this would essentially alleviate a surety of its responsibility to bring a defendant back.
So, counsel, the argument is, had they gotten notice, they could have moved forward with an attempt to have an extradition order, and that was that time and that the ability to do so was lost.
Your Honor, it's never been argued by the appellant why they couldn't seek an extradition order after receiving notice. That's never been made clear. I don't know why they couldn't have sought.
Well, there's no timeline on an extradition order, is there? I mean, you've got to file it within X amount of days when somebody's taken in custody and placed in detention.
I'm not aware of a time frame, but. Appellant has not.
So you say there's no reason why they couldn't have done an extradition order at any juncture, any time.
Exactly.
Okay. So had they done so and not been able to secure one, taking us to the second proposition of law, why isn't his detention in Kentucky an impossibility for appearance in Ohio?
I appreciate that question, Your Honor, because I was about to move on to Proposition 2 that nicely dovetails into.
You're welcome.
So the impossibility of performance doctrine is well established in Ohio. There are a number of conditions wherein a party to a contract is relieved of performance because of impossibility. Those reasons are an act of God, an act of the obligee. In this case, the obligee would be the state of Ohio. Or an act of law, or the condition is simply unforeseeable.
So why isn't this under that act of law category?
So, Your Honor, the decision State v. Hughes, which is law that this court issued, it found that the risk that assured that a defendant will flee the state of Ohio is always foreseeable. That has been almost uniformly found by Ohio courts. I cannot find a single decision from any district or this court that found that it was unforeseeable for a defendant to flee the jurisdiction.
But fleeing the state and being lawfully detained, being incarcerated, are different. I mean, if they came in and said, Your Honor, we have reason to believe that our client is in Kentucky or California or Iowa, and we're trying to locate him, is one thing. But saying our client is in a jail in Kentucky, so therefore lawfully detained.
To that, Your Honor, I would say that the defendant violated, it's important to note that the defendant violated the terms of this agreement with the state of Ohio and voluntarily left the jurisdiction. This recognizance is essentially a contract. The state of Ohio agreed to allow the defendant out of jail in exchange for the surety and the defendant to uphold its conditions under the bond. One of those conditions was not to depart the state of Ohio. Hamilton County, where this case took place, borders two states.
But is the forfeiture because he left the state, or is the forfeiture because he is not appearing?
Well, Your Honor, the unfortunate answer to that question is we often don't know if a defendant violates the terms by leaving the state unless the defendant is arrested. That's just simply mechanically how it generally works.
If he does leave the state, even if it's to go over and, you know, spend the weekend with his family, that's a violation.
That is a violation, Your Honor.
Okay, and the only what you're saying, though, you would not know about that if he came back and he was present in the state of Ohio.
In practice, Your Honor, there's really no way for us to know that they depart the state.
Well, that leads me to my next question. I'm not real familiar with how the bondsman keeps track of the people that are out on bond under, you know, once the surety, obviously they've got somebody on the ground that is supposed to be in contact with these people. Are they required to wear an ankle bracelet? Are they, you know, for a GPS? Are they required to phone in every day, maybe three times a day? How's that work?
I'm not sure what the individual sureties require. We have many bail bondsmen in Hamilton County. Each one might have its own requirements. In terms of an ankle bracelet, the state would only require an ankle bracelet if the judge made that a term and condition of the bond, an electronic monitoring provision. I don't believe there was one in this case. Of course, there was nothing preventing a surety from taking additional steps, and actually,
that's my point. You know, a risk is a risk, and if you're going to minimize your risk, you have an agreement with the defendant. You know, we're going to help you out here, but here's what you need to do in order to minimize the risk. And as you said, you know, somebody could go across state lines, not get arrested, and not do anything illegal, or maybe do something illegal and not get caught, and then just the very fact that they've left the state is a violation of the terms of both their promise to the state and their agreement with the surety.
To that, Your Honor, I would say that that's something that the surety and the defendant need to take up between themselves. It should not prejudice the state of Ohio if a surety is not taking appropriate steps to ensure a defendant who's in a county that borders two different states.
That's kind of my point here. I'm trying to figure out how, you know, how they can be relieved of responsibility here.
Your Honor, it's of course my position that they can't be.
What about appearing?
I'm sorry?
What about appearing?
Like, if he appeared in court, then
even if he went across state lines, is that a forfeiture?
If the state was aware that he had violated the terms and conditions of his bond, it could result in a forfeiture.
Okay. Yes. But even if he appeared for all of his court hearings?
Possibly so, Your Honor.
Okay.
Mr. Sayre, the March 24th entry doesn't adopt the magistrate's decision. So is there some kind of an argument that the subsequent hearing that the trial judge held on what was actually more of a motion for reconsideration and not necessarily objections, they were too late to file objections. Does that somehow supersede that, or?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe the state of the record was that we had agreed between myself and counsel to allow late objections, which is why they came so late. So from my perspective, I don't believe that the objections were untimely. I think that was resolved by agreement.
It was a motion for reconsideration and to set aside bond forfeiture judgment and release surety from liability from magistrate's decision dated September 27, 2019. So the trial court denied those motions didn't specifically say that it was adopting the magistrate's decision. Is it good enough? Is its entry on March 24th good enough for us to have jurisdiction in the case?
I'm not sure of the answer to that, Your Honor. Like I said at the beginning, it would have been my practice to submit an additional entry after it was overruled. Of course, the notice of appeal came down so quickly that and the case was stayed, I didn't have an opportunity to do so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've used your time. You can take a minute.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Yes, pulling out appendix number 17, there's not a actual, this is a final appealable order, but I do believe that the way that this case proceeded, this was the final appealable order based upon the hearing of November 2019.
But there's no magic words reduced to paper in an order from a judge in this case that says I adopt the magistrate's decision. And that historically has been what is necessary in order to trigger jurisdiction. So what do we do?
I believe that you have jurisdiction. I believe that this March 24th, 2020 order, even though he does not say the magical words, it was very much the final appealable order as we had proceeded through this process of our late appearance and the allowance to issue our objections. I can't say anything else because you're right. It is, the magical language is not in here.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision.